From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We can all deal with it together on a bipartisan basis because the impact of major decisions can be so lasting and can have such a dramatic change on the future of the state. To have those decisions made by folks who are on their way out of office, in their last few days in office, that would be very inappropriate.
Well, I think when you're sworn in, I've been sworn in as governor, and you're not sworn in for part of your term. Every day counts. And every day of your term, you have to be ready to do your job. And I would say to all the legislators, this is not holiday time. This is working time. Your job is to work for the public good. And I would say on the minimum wage, if you really want to help people back home, raise the wage and do your job, because that's what the people want you to do.
That was lame duck Governor Pat Quinn urging lawmakers to raise the minimum wage before the end of the year. Before that, we heard Governor-elect Bruce Rauner saying lawmakers ought not do anything substantive until he takes office. The Illinois House and Senate are back in session next week for the start of the annual fall veto session. We'll recap all things politic from the past week with this panel. Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Brian Mackey with WUIS and Illinois Issues. And joining us as our guest today, Jamie Dunn, Executive Editor of Illinois Issues Magazine. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Guys, it took a while, but we understand Pat Quinn finally reached out, made a phone call to Bruce Rauner this week for a short phone conversation. Brian Mackey?
Yeah, this was, you'll remember on election night, he did not immediately concede. Apparently, even though he was some 170,000 votes down, there were still people actually waiting in line in Chicago, some until 3 a.m. in order to cast their ballots. And what we've heard is that, you know, he just didn't really feel it was appropriate while there were people, waiting to cast ballots, presumably for him, as most people in Chicago or the majority of people in Chicago did, that he didn't want to concede. So it took until the following afternoon, the Wednesday after Election Day, came out, spoke for less than 3 minutes, didn't use his opponent's name at all, and then waited. We've heard another week after that before he finally called Bruce Rauner and actually had a conversation with him about the transition and what's going to happen next.
In the short conversation, they also apparently talked about the Affordable Care Act. But I happen to think this probably didn't reflect that well on Quinn. The sore loser effect came through. I know in the scheme of things, it doesn't really matter whether they end up talking to each other. They're not going to be close pals or anything. But, Charlie, is that unusual that we, in a governor's race, we don't see that phone call take place right away?
To be honest, I can't really say. And the reason I say that is because I can't remember the last time. I guess the last time an incumbent governor was beaten would have been the Democratic primary in 1976 when Michael Hollett beat Dan Walker. And I don't remember if Dan Walker called Michael Hollett or not. Dan Walker was kind of on the outs with most of the regular Democrats, well, from the day he declared that he was going to run for governor in, I guess, late 71, early 72. So I really don't know. This is once in longevity doesn't help.
But I think it's a pretty standard thing you hear, certainly with presidential elections. I remember John McCain, I believe Mitt Romney as well, coming out and say, I just called my opponent. You know, there's sort of a message, now we have to come together. You try and be the bigger person in that situation oftentimes. This was a very bitter campaign, though. There were a lot of...
I think that may have been part of it, though,
yeah.
Too. You know, this is the most negative campaign that I can recall for governor. And maybe back in the 1800s, there were worse, because I've seen stories in Illinois Times, looking back at where there were actual brawls involved. And
Governor Palmer used to carry a revolver with him to some political events.
Yeah. But the ads were relentless, they were overwhelming, they were nonstop, and they were totally negative. And I could see why that would leave a bad taste in somebody's mouth.
Well, Jamie Dunn, and you were sitting in the front row, at least at one of those debates, and clearly Governor Quinn just looked unhappy when he had to shake hands with Bruce Rauner.
Yeah, there's no love lost there. I mean, that was pretty obvious when we were waiting for the debate to start. The two candidates, you know, no really chatting it up. No, it was very awkward. There was no kind of joking around or anything to break that awkwardness. I don't know if it came across on television, but Governor Quinn turned fairly red a few times when Governor-elect Bruce Rauner was answering questions. You could see the frustration on his face.
When it comes to the smoothness of a gubernatorial transition, are the previous administrations usually fairly cooperative? I mean, I have no fact basis that the Quinn administration won't, but I've heard on the grapevine that's a possibility. Does it really matter or at transition time, or do you usually see pretty good work between administrations, Charlie?
Well, I think in the past there's been pretty close cooperation.
Of course, for many years it was just a Republican
to Republican, yeah. But I suspect that the people will be professional on this and go forward. The problems that are there are so large that you can't afford to be petty about trying to help your successors get off on a good foot. A lot of it depends on the people that Governor-elect Rauner decides to bring in, people that I would say probably one of the more critical appointments will be who does he want to be the budget director, because that's going to be the major challenge. And I don't see there, you know, like we said the other day, I don't think anybody's going to disable the A key on the computer keyboard or anything like that.
Yeah, you know, we've maybe heard some rumors that that they may not be bending over backwards, but Governor Quinn did appoint Ryan Croak to help with the transition. He's not an adversarial guy. He's somebody Quinn does bring in when things maybe need some smoothing over in the past. So that choice indicates that, you know, it's probably not going to be this really adversarial thing. But, yeah, I mean, they may not be helping him out with every little detail either.
A couple of people that Bruce Rauner reached out to. The first time we weren't sure when he said he had called the Speaker of the House and the Senate President, and then it came out that maybe it was a voicemail, maybe it was staff talking to staff. He met this week, Bruce Rauner did, with House Speaker Michael Madigan and Senate President John Cullerton in a private meeting that lasted a little over 2 hours. All anybody would really say was this was looking forward, and it was a cordial meeting.
Yeah, I think the legislative leaders have kind of, to a certain extent, gone out of their way to not be too adversarial towards Mr. Rauner. There was this dust-up where Rauner had said in his victory speech that he placed two very important phone calls to House Speaker Madigan and Senate President Cullerton, and I told them that we need to work together. Well, it turns out that he had spoken to a staffer for Cullerton, and he had apparently left a voicemail for Speaker Madigan's chief of staff that it took several days to figure out because it was an unmarked call or an unknown caller on his cell phone, which he had ignored, blah, blah, blah.
It wasn't Rauner personally.
It was one of his staff. And so, but you could get the sense in the coverage of that the leaders were not trying to make a big deal out of it. But, you know, we in the press kind of appreciate it when politicians are straightforward and say what they, you know, say exactly what they're doing and don't, you know, finagle things. Like if you say you called someone, we would like it that you actually called someone. But the Speaker and the Senate President, through their spokespeople, were not stoking that story. So, I mean, they were not trying to instigate any fights. And it seemed like coming out of this meeting in Chicago, which was on neutral ground, I thought that was interesting. It was at a private club. It was not in any of their offices. They also were not trying to pick fights at that point. However, we did hear Senate President Cullerton in an interview on election night had said that, the income tax extension, if that's going to happen now, if, you know, we need to continue funding state government, well, that's going to be a Rauner tax now, basically, that he's waiting for Bruce Rauner to make the first move on that. So it's not going to be a smooth road, I wouldn't think, but, they're not starting out with weapons drawn necessarily.
And Mr. Rauner insists he will be meeting at least every person that is in the state legislature. And when the legislature gathers in the coming week at the state capitol for fall veto, he plans to be roaming the halls a little bit.
Yeah, what's interesting, especially about the potential Rauner and Cullerton relationship, is that the campaign that Rauner conducted he couldn't have been, I know he wasn't setting out to do this, but if he wanted to push John Cullerton's buttons, the messaging in that campaign definitely hit all the right notes for that, as far as being negative about what, you know, the direction that Illinois is headed in. The Senate Democrats have started this I Like Illinois social media push. President Cullerton, if you talk to him for very long, will often complain about how there are certain folks in the state that are dogging on Illinois too often. So, you know, there are definitely some really clear points of contention between those two men. They may be able to put it to the side and get to work. We'll see. But there are definitely some things that that Bruce Rauner sort of brought up over and over again during his campaign that I'm sure got under Senate President Cullerton's skin a bit.
Then again, they're both Chicago people, right? I mean, in a sense. And this is something that people are beginning to wonder about. You know, well, it's well known that Democratic Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel is good friends with Bruce Rauner. He was the one, of course, holding that very, very expensive bottle of wine from the greater than $100,000 wine club that we learned that Bruce Rauner was a member of in a photo. I guess they've vacationed together in the past. Mayor Emanuel did, of course, support Governor Quinn, supported the Democrat. That's not too surprising, but they do have a close relationship. I mean, some people are beginning to wonder, could there be some compromise possible? Because Bruce Rauner is not the traditional downstate Republican who gets a lot of support by beating up on Chicago.
And as Charlie has mentioned, probably on more than one occasion on this show, and that is, Charlie, you always felt the House Speaker got along better with Republicans than some Democrats anyway, and certainly Rod Blagojevich. I mean,
well, if you look at the Democratic governors during the time that I covered, as I mentioned, it was Dan Walker, and nobody got along with him. Well, I shouldn't say that. There was a handful of...
Pat Quinn got along with him, as we think.
Well, but Pat Quinn was one of his staffers, and there were a handful of members in the General Assembly who got along with Walker. But by and large, neither Republicans nor Democrats really liked Dan Walker. Rod Blagojevich, Senate President Emil Jones, got along with him very well. Mike Madigan was probably the major obstacle in the legislature to Blagojevich doing a lot of stuff that people thought was not a good idea. On the other hand, you look at Madigan working with Governor Thompson, working with Governor Edgar, working with Governor Ryan. At the end of the day, they sat down and they did what needed to be done. In retrospect, some of the decisions made about budgeting, for example, not fully funding pensions, probably were a mistake. But there was a sense that the people involved were adults, they were pragmatic, they could get things done. And I see Bruce Rauner as being somebody who really is not an ideologue. I think if you look carefully at all the stuff he said during the campaign, you don't really have a clue what he thinks about a lot of these policies. He's not laid out any details, which on the one hand, I was one who was critical of because I like to see what people are going to do when they're running. But on the other hand, it gives him the ability to reach any kind of accommodation that might be necessary with the Democratic legislature.
Yeah, I was just thinking about what you were saying about Speaker Madigan's difficult relationship with Blagojevich. It was on the wiretaps. That was President Obama was elected, and you know the FBI really got interested in what Blagojevich was doing with that Senate seat in Illinois. One of the things on the wiretaps that still sticks out in my mind is he was saying, you know, we got to figure out how to get rid of the speaker so we can get Democrat bleep done here in Illinois. And even then, you know, the speaker was an obstacle to what Blagojevich wanted to do. So he is, yeah, he's not a very liberal guy unless that suits his interests and what he's doing. You know, same-sex marriage was an example. When he decided that that would be a good issue for the House to pass, that's when it passed. But I do wonder, you're right, Rauner left himself a lot of wiggle room. Could they become, allies in some way? I don't know. There was an awful lot of negative campaigning again, getting back to what we were talking about earlier and that 100 years of failure advertisement. Could certainly stick in his craw.
Well, I would think with any major politician, though, you're an ally of convenience anyway.
Yeah. And what has always been Madigan's chief concern, electing Democrats to the House. Mm-hmm. What does having a Republican governor do for him? It means that on all these tough votes, the Republicans who've been on the sidelines throwing stones, you know, for the last dozen years, suddenly they're going to have to put people on these roll calls. If there's going to be tax increases, there are going to be Republican votes on those tax increases. If there are going to be severe budget cuts, those are going to be Republican votes that help put them through. On the other hand, all of Madigan's targets, all of his people who were in, what would you say, suspect districts where he thought some of them might lose, they all won, but some of them were shaky. They now get a pass. They don't have to vote for any of that hard stuff, and they can go out and campaign against it because they would have voted no on the tax increase, and Republican votes would be what would put across. And as was said earlier, it's going to be Bruce Rauner's tax increase. It's going to be Bruce Rauner's budget cuts. Part of being a governor is you own the thing. When the income tax was implemented in Illinois back in 1969, that legislation would not have passed were it not for Democratic votes supplied by Mayor Richard J. Daley in return for getting a slice of the proceeds. When the Republican governor, Richard Ogilvie, ran for re-election, it was Ogilvie's income tax that helped doom him. It wasn't Ogilvie slash Daley income tax. The governor always wears the collar. It doesn't matter whether he's a Republican or a Democrat. It's the governor's administration. He proposes the budget. He takes the initiative. And he gets the credit or the blame.
This is State Week in Review. Coming up, what the legislature might do when it returns next week, and the Illinois treasurer's race still too close to call.
Support for State Week in Review comes from Illinois Issues Magazine, a public affairs magazine deciphering Springfield legislation and the state of the state. This month's features include the plight of young African American males. Also, is Illinois facing a possible casino overload? Illinois Issues and its companion publication, The Roster of State Government Officials, is available at illinoisissues.uis.edu.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Illinois Issues' Jamie Dunn. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Well, as we mentioned, the legislature is back for its fall veto session, and then that'll lead into its lame duck session in January. Guys, what might we expect when they show up in Springfield this week?
It's always hard to predict, but I mean, I think the fall veto session is expected to be a little anticlimactic. I doubt we're going to see a lot going on. The biggest issue out there, of course, is that veto of the Uber regulation legislation. That will probably be one of the biggest stories that we will see in the coming weeks. If we do see any major movement, it would be in that January lame duck session, most likely.
And Uber is the private rides or private taxi service, I guess we could say.
You can have a smart. There's a smartphone app. You can hit a button and page one of these vehicles to you. The cab drivers don't like this because the Uber drivers are not don't necessarily have to have the same insurance requirements and the same training and regulation, and so they say it's anti-competitive for them. On the other hand, Governor Quinn did veto this bill that would have regulated Uber. Bruce Rauner had even gotten ahead of the governor on that and urged him to veto it. That's one of the as an ad I saw recently about this says it's one of the few areas where they actually agreed during the campaign, and so. But it's not clear to me that they have enough votes necessarily to do this override, again, especially when you have Bruce Rauner out there urging lawmakers to do as little as possible. One of the other issues we may see come up and that we heard at the top of the show the governor is pushing is to do this minimum wage increase. I think it's fascinating that you look at the ballot question. There was that advisory question. Shall Illinois increase its minimum wage to $10 an hour by January 1st of next year? That got 650,000 more votes than the governor who tied himself directly to that issue so much. So that is something that, you know we can say with certainty is popular with people who voted in the last election. But if enough lawmakers will go along with it, that's an open question.
And something interesting, Jamie Dunn, is the governor, while he has indicated he wants to do that legislation, when he was speaking to the U of I Board of Trustees, he still trumpeted it, but almost made it sound as if he was, or speaking this week, he was urging the governor-elect to make sure he does it. It seemed a little odd.
Yeah, it's like he's hedging his bets a little at his press conference yesterday.
Yeah, that's
where he definitely, talked up wanting to get it done. The clip that played at the beginning of the show saying that the lame duck lawmakers are elected to office for all of their term, not, you know, just part of it, and that they should still show up and do what he sees as being their jobs by passing this wage increase. But he also almost more forcefully called upon Bruce Rauner to pass a minimum wage increase in the same press conference. I don't know if that means a lot, but it was kind of interesting that he seemed to put more emphasis on calling on Bruce Rauner to get this done, maybe thinking that, you know, it's not going to happen.
Well, but it's what's interesting to me is Bruce Rauner has had a number of positions on the minimum wage. There's he did interviews and he had speaking engagements where he said it actually should be lowered, which, you know, there are economists who will make that argument. Not too many politicians will make that argument. And then in the end, his final position on it was, well, I could support an increase if it was coupled with these pro-business reforms, as he referred to them. This includes what is changes to the tort system, where, the way people can sue and the kind of damages they can get. As with a lot of Mr. Rauner's policy statements during the campaign, it was not really specific on what exactly that means. And I have questions about that because the Illinois Supreme Court has multiple times in the past said that the biggest thing that people who want to, push so-called tort reform is caps on non-economic damages, pain and suffering, the amount of money you can win in a lawsuit. And the Illinois Supreme Court has multiple times said that that is not constitutional here in Illinois. So it's not clear to me that you could even get some of these pro-business pieces of legislation, passed that he's talking about that he wants in order to raise the minimum wage.
There is some interest from one of the sponsors of the increase that we've seen around for a while, Kim Lightford, Democratic senator, to add some pro-business things. I remember her talking about this last year, I believe, after the State of the State address, saying that she had been talking to business groups about ways that they could kind of soften the blow of this. Of course, it probably wouldn't get them on board supporting it, but things that they could do to make it less hard on them. Of course, she didn't get specific on what those things would be. I doubt they would go as far as some of the things that Bruce Rauner has called for, but there is some interest there, at least with one of the sponsors, of trying to find some common ground with business groups that predates Bruce Rauner calling for that.
Tom Cross and Mike Frericks, the Republican and Democratic candidates respectively for state treasurer, are still in a close battle, Charlie Wheeler. The latest that you know, where are we on this vote count?
Well, I don't have the exact numbers at hand, but put it this way, at the moment, Cross appears to be ahead by several hundred votes, which works out to something, my
0.02, according to the Illinois election data website, which is run by a guy as a hobby, as I understand it.
Well, I was going to say it works out something like one vote every 20 precincts, my rough math. But the one thing we can be certain of is that this will go down in history as the closest statewide general election in Illinois ever, and one of the closest, if not the closest, in the whole nation. And we probably will not know. It's possible we won't know until, hours before one of those gentlemen is sworn in as the treasurer. The process now is that county clerks and election officials, election commission officials across the state, are counting absentee ballots as they come in. And any ballot that was postmarked by Election Day and arrives by the 18th of November gets counted. There are also thousands of provisional ballots that were cast where someone comes in and votes and somebody challenges them, and their credentials are checked. If I come in and I say, well, I'm registering to vote today on Election Day, I haven't done it before, and here's where I live, the election authorities set that ballot aside, and then after the election, they go back and they check and say, well, does Wheeler really live there or not? And this goes on, and there's been tens of thousands of these all across the state. On the 18th, the election authorities at the local level have to finish their counting. They send the stuff into Springfield, and I believe it's on the 25th that the State Board of Election has to certify the results and say, here are the official results. At that point, I'm assuming that whether it's Frerichs or Cross who comes out behind, they will challenge that. They will ask for a recount. And that may drag on and take an awfully long time before it's finally settled.
And Jamie Dunn, the Cross folks who have the narrow lead right now, have tried to at least sell the story to reporters that there's something nefarious or not right, I guess maybe would be a better.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely pushing the narrative that things are kind of a mess, especially in Cook County, and that there might be some voter fraud going on here. It's really hard for us to know what's going on since we're not there monitoring, you know, with the vote count or anything like that. One of the things that they've been complaining about is that people maybe voted more than once or cast more than one vote through a mail-in ballot and a provisional ballot. But, of course, I mean, that's what election judges are doing right now, sorting those out. That's very possible that that could have happened, but it doesn't mean that they'll get counted. That's why we go through this process, is to make sure that each person, you know, is who they say they are, lives where they say they live, like Charlie just said, and only casts one vote that is counted.
Well, one of the complaints I saw was that at one point the Cook County clerk had said, here's how many ballots we have to count. And then the next day there were like several thousand more. And so Cross's people are saying, well, where did the extra ballots come from? Well, think about it, doofus. People send in their absentee ballot by mail. Guess what? The post office doesn't deliver all of them on the same day. And the next day there might be more coming in.
Wait, you're saying the mail isn't delivered perfectly efficiently with speed and dispatch all the time? Charlie.
Not 100% of the time.
I would just like to point out one small little weird historical fact here. The current difference that Rich Miller is reporting on his blog, which, as I said, is tied to this Illinois election data, which this guy runs as a hobby, because I think the AP, who most of us in the press rely on to count votes, actually stopped doing that last week. The difference is 537 votes, which coincidentally is the exact same number that separated Bush and Gore in Florida in 2000.
At least a hanging chad won't be part of the issue.
Yeah, I think we've gotten beyond that here in Illinois
this time around. So, well, the recount process, if that happens, will this be? Will we be watching a lot of action in court, or will we be? Will this be a recount?
I think the way the process begins is you have to go to court, and you have to cite certain precincts that you would like to have recounted, and you do. I think it's called a discovery recount initially, and if it turns out that it looks like you're doing well, then you can ask for the full recount. But it's a pretty costly venture. I forget, it's something like $100 a precinct. And you have to pay the costs. And so it shouldn't be a problem for a statewide candidate to raise the money, but it's a very tedious, laborious process. I remember years ago there was a recount of an Illinois House race, and it took the better part of the spring session before the House Elections Committee was able to determine who the winner was.
And that's our time this week for State Week. One other mention, another congressman, former congressman, passed away this week. Phil Crane, longtime congressman in the northwest suburbs of Chicago, known for his anti-tax stance, and he made a run for president back in 1980. He passed away. That's our time for this edition of State Week. Thanks to our guest, Jamie Dunn of Illinois Issues. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org. Or you can use iTunes by searching for State Week in Review or at iTunes U. Production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.